Welcome to the Payments and Cards Network podcast. Today is a very special live edition. We have Casey Potenzone in the Amsterdam office with us. It was great to receive Casey. He spent the whole afternoon visiting the good people of Payments and Cards Network. We've done a relatively long show where we really deep dived on Nextway's various products and services. This is probably one of the most innovative e-commerce technology companies out there right now. Big changes coming. They're doing more and more. Watch out for this company in 2020. Without further ado, I give you Casey Potenzone.
Today on the Payments and Cards Network podcast, we have Casey Potenzone. He is the Chief Strategy Officer for Nextway. Casey, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Casey, I start the podcast off with the same question for all of our guests. Could you basically introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what it is you do?
So I have a bit of an interesting background in that I grew up during the dot-com bubble of the 90s. And so as being somebody going to college in New York City in the late 90s, I had the very, I consider, fortunate opportunity of being able to drop out of college and get a job programming immediately.
Nice.
So I started out doing work for, doing consulting work with advertising firms, moved to MTV where I ran digital media, wrote a couple of patents in technology, ran data centers and operations, all along the time, mostly in startups. And so I recognized in my career path that if I ever wanted to successfully run and operate a business, I needed to understand how they made money. And so I consciously made a decision to pivot my career from technical operations and development into business development and sales. And so around age 30, 32 or something, I made that change. And since then, I've been working more in the business development and the financial development of companies. And this has given me a very great portfolio of skills and talents. Sometimes I'm driving our IT and technical teams crazy because I understand what they're saying and I can argue with them. Same thing on the business side is that you typically don't have sales guys walking in who can speak to the developers in their language. And that has ultimately led to very successful product development and company development.
Great. What made you at that time want to pivot from more technical or product focused backgrounds into business development? That's quite an unusual change there.
It's because I wanted to run the companies. And so I had worked for a number of different startups, and what I saw was the CEO was always a sales guy. And the founder or co-founders usually stepped aside to allow that business guy to run their companies. And so the successful startups were founders who moved aside, hired a business person that knew how to monetize that technology. And again, that word monetize will keep coming up throughout my career, because it's always been about, you might have brilliant technology, but if you don't know how to bring it to your customer, it doesn't matter. And that is when I had that revelation that sitting in the back office writing some awesome anti-hacking technologies and we couldn't get it to market, that I needed to go and start doing that myself, really, it changed my career and opened up a lot of opportunities for me.
Absolutely. Let's bring this into the present then. You're now at Nextway. What made you choose to go over to this company when you did? I believe it's been a good 7, 8, maybe 9 years since you've been with Nextway.
So it's been about 5 years, going on 6 years. The Nextway's been one of those companies in the space for a very long time. When I'd worked for several competitors at this point. When I was looking at Nextway, I'd always thought of them as a really high-end boutique, a company that had a few very exclusive customers that we could never penetrate. And selling against them, I knew the team rather well. And so when I had made a career change, I'd taken off a few months, went back into the market, really didn't know the best angle to approach finding a new job again, because it had been so many years, I called colleagues that I had known. And one of them was Christian Desert, who was the CEO of Nextway at this time. Mm-hmm. And Christian and I had known each other, and it took us about 2 days of conversations to realize there was a fit and an opportunity to work together. And so Nextway, to me, had always been a competitor that was really at the high end.
Yeah.
Not the biggest, but very polished. And so when it came opportunity to work with this organization, I jumped on it. And the multinational aspect of the company was really one of the most appealing aspects.
Let's open up that company for a moment then. Just for our audience who may have never heard of Nextway, what does the company do and what is its background?
So the Nextway of today is the result of a merger between Nextway and AskNet that has taken place over the last 12 months. Both companies are about 80% the same. Our core DNA is operating as merchant of record for software companies. we essentially are the reseller. We're the reseller that enables a software company to operate successfully in the local market. The other 20% of each business was distribution and content. And so we were selling video games, we were selling academic software, but the core of everything we do is knowing who the local customer is in whichever market you're targeting. So the difference between France and Italy, for example, is rather significant in how you sell and how you convert. And that's truly what has made Nextway so successful, is that we understand that nuance and we target that nuance. Mm-hmm. And so if you take a company like Adobe, for example, Adobe sells in 180 countries. That's 180 tax returns. That's 180 potential different currencies, languages, payment methods. All of that intersecting matrix means that for Adobe to be successful, they also need to be a multinational accounting firm. Adobe can do that. Take a $50 million software company in the US or in China that's trying to do that, and it's not possible. They look at companies like Nextway to be able to bring them into the local markets and create an opportunity to truly behave as if you were running in France, running in Germany, running in Brazil.
Got it. Let's look at some of the ways in which you achieved that then. Just going on the website, we can read about Nextway Monetize and Nextway Connect. How do you help these gigantic companies become more localized using some of these products and services? What do they do exactly?
Okay, so I'll start with the simpler one, which is Connect. Connect, and then on the German side of the company, we also have an academics unit that are very similar. What we do is move licensing and entitlement through a distribution network. So if a video game company, for example, Bethesda or Take-Two, if they want to sell to the end consumer, they want to go through resellers in different markets, they need middlemen to facilitate this. And that's what Connect is. It's a distribution platform for content entitlement licensing. Same on the academic side. But the real core of the company comes to Monetize. And Monetize is the result of several years of heads down development, purely on payment management and payment enablement. So you can think of Nextway as your payments team. Mm. In many ways, we are a reseller looking for customer optimization, but really Monetize is about understanding the right time for the right payment method, with the right interface. And so we utilize this platform, and we operate under the headless commerce monikers, which means that we don't really care what shopping cart you want to use. And we're fully aware of the fact that monetizing your customer, right? Again and again, it's that monetize word. So extracting the financial value of your intellectual property through the customer interaction, mm-hmm. It may happen on a computer screen, it might happen on mobile. Now it's starting to happen on our computer, on our car screens, it's happening on the point of sale, the cash register, all these different interfaces that we have. It's also happening in our refrigerators. It's happening with all these IoT devices.
Yep.
And so where companies are succeeding is that when the customer wants to interact, wants to buy, let them.
Yes.
Headless commerce means that, one, we decentralize the catalog approach, so it's much simpler to do the pricing, the monetization. But two, we do it via pure API. So if you want to interact with your customer in a Twitter window, or if I'm chatting to you on Messenger and trying to make a reservation and you need to deposit, or if it's going through email and you want to send me a cart, or if I'm on my phone inside an app and you want to pop up a embedded native screen, as a product manufacturer, you know the best time to talk to your customer. As a payments company, we give you the best methods to monetize that interaction. And so that's really what our platform and our product is all about, is giving and empowering our partners, software publishers, content developers, game companies, and in some more extreme cases, we have new business models coming to market, mm-hmm. But it's all about empowering them to take the transaction and interact with the customer the way the customer wants, when the customer wants to do it.
Like it. Headless commerce. Is that a term that you came up with, Casey? It's really a good one.
I think it's been going around the market for a little while. It's gotten a little bit more buzzwordy in the last 12 or 18 months. So we sort of played it down a little bit, just natural inclination is to avoid buzzwords. But what it really means to us is, and me personally, having run distribution and physical operations, you come encounter again and again with material master record requirements and the master of record and master data setups. These are huge, huge implications that are typically run by ERP programs. Again, when you look at most operations, you don't want to involve an ERP program about integrating with a payments company. And so headless commerce to me was about moving the necessity of a catalog from 5, 6, 7 different providers to hosting it and leaving it where it belongs, which is with the publisher or the manufacturer. And so in our case, the software publisher, they typically will deal with ourselves and some competitors, which means that they replicate their product catalog 3, 4, 5, 10 times. Mm. The next way approach with headless commerce is that as a software publisher, you know your product catalog, you know your pricing, you know your business you want to run. We integrate and we take our direction from you instead of duplicating that and maintaining our own setup. And this has created an opportunity for us to very quickly respond to market environments. So when our publishers want to run campaigns or they're responding to a threat from their competitors where they need to quickly get to market with a discount or a promotion, they could do it with NextWave without changing the catalogs. And that versus where we were 2 years ago, 5 years ago, is a difference of weeks,
yep.
Which when it comes to monetization of your customer, imagine you're sitting on, it's today, and your competitor just announced that on Black Friday, they're going to change the pricing or release a different variation on your product. You now have 24 or 48 hours to respond to it.
Right.
So with that concept, you're either going to go heads down into bunker mode with 5 people trying to update a catalog presentation to all your resellers, or if you've got a headless commerce system in place, you change it in your core and it replicates through its environment in milliseconds.
Amazing, amazing. I'm gonna take it in a new direction. You mentioned about giving some of your customers a competitive advantage. You've got a long list of illustrious customers for a relatively small company. NextWave gets to work with some of the biggest names in the market. Some of these are major security and cybersecurity companies that are often fiercely competing. What does NextWave do to maintain integrity and make sure there's a firewall between its various customers? I imagine this is really, really key.
So this is a really good one. I think it speaks volumes to the integrity of an organization when your customers are so fiercely competitive amongst themselves. So we follow all this, the routine standards of data segregation, compliance with GDPR, compliance with business and trade practices. But what we've really done is this, in our DNA, we run these businesses. We run subscription businesses. We have customers that are 7 years old, 8 years old in renewals, which is unheard of in the space.
Yeah.
The reason why, and I truly believe this, the reason why you can look amongst our customers and see so many that compete within themselves is that the integrity of our business isolates and puts silos around their practices so they're safe, but it's also the quality of our tools. And when you look at subscription management and subscription renewals, customer interaction, customer care, and brand development, we may run 3 brands out of 1 call center. But when you pick up the phone and contact us, the guy who answers the phone or the girl who answers the phone knows how to install a software, knows how to manage a software, knows how to access the silo and what the product is all about. And so all of these little silos are fiercely focused on brand development and brand protection. And so while we bring amazing products to the market for our customers to monetize their subscriptions, to upsell, to realize the full potential of their customer base, we also do it in such a way that our core team provides account management services or customer success services that are truly unique and built upon years of understanding of how those businesses work. So our account managers who are working in the security space, for example, they know what it takes to convert a consumer. And right now we're seeing in digital streaming a huge, fierce battle between Disney and Netflix and Hulu and the likes. This has been going on in security and antivirus for a very long time. Mm. And many of these customers use our tools to interact with our customer, their end users, because of the success we've had.
Yep.
In many cases, we're looking at 86, 88, 90% retention rates. And we just executed a brand new payments project that we're nearing completion, where we expect to, by changing who we work with for card acquiring in France, we're expecting to be able to bump up our renewal rates above 90%.
Wow.
And so this has nothing to do with marketing. It has nothing to do with the customer interaction. It has to do with back-end core payments technology. And through this coupling of a team that understands how to interact with your customer, who knows what trade and compliance laws are to run safely in France or Brazil or the US, and a payments team that again understands the nuance of what a basis point means to multi-million dollar businesses, right? And so when we hunt, we're at the point now where we're looking for basis points because we've already optimized all the big upgrades. Mm-hmm. And now we're trying to figure out how do I take 90% and make it 91%? And that's not easy. Yeah. Going from 60 to 70, 60 to 80, that's a lot. But that project, I would argue, is easier than going from 88 to 90.
Yep.
And that's where we thrive.
That 90 to 91 to 92, why does that every extra percentile get more and more difficult there? What exactly are you chasing down there?
It's so at this point, you're tuning things that are maybe out of your control. For example, funds not available. And this is one of the tricks and the nuances that you understand in the payments world when you've spent too much time in the payments world. Any of the Americans listening know full well about overdrafts. And what an overdraft is when the bank knows who you are and knows they can get the money out of you, and they literally grant you credit on an overdraft, right? So you're running a subscription for $9.99, and many American companies with a low credit card balance will simply renew it and charge you an overdraft fee. So they always renew. Yeah. It's always success, even when funds aren't available. That works if you understand who the card issuers are. And that works if you understand who the banks are that represent the majority of your population. And so in France, for example, by identifying who the largest issuers of Visa or MasterCard are and using them for acquiring, we're able to tackle things like funds not available, right? And so short of giving that customer some money, how do you deal with a credit card that doesn't have the funds available to commit the transaction? And you do that by optimizing who your acquirers are. And so by moving our traffic between different acquirers who are the largest issuers in market, we tackle that problem. Mm-hmm. So funds not available is one. Subscription renewal histories. Literally, we have a product called Smart Replay. And what Smart Replay was about is understanding through business intelligence when credit card transactions are successful or open banking transactions are successful, and then starting to try to figure out why. We learned some crazy things, like, for example, everyone in France, I'll keep picking out France, I spend so much time in this market, but it's for that reason. But we learned very quickly that the French markets run their credit card batches at the start of the business day. And so this correlates to staff coming in, right? So you have staff coming into the office, then they execute their jobs.
Yep.
And so they all run them in the morning so that when they get there, they can look at the results of the batch processing. What that means is that all the e-commerce companies running subscriptions in France are doing it at the same time. So you will, by just the sheer nature of systems, have conflicts, have collisions, and you'll be fighting for resources. So if you move your replay of transactions in France or in Italy or the US outside those time zones, you have greater acceptance rates. And we're talking basis points, but when you start looking at the things like when the systems run, and then you start coupling in machine learning, such as what day of the month is it? What day of the week is it? The general population tends to get paid around the same time. They tend to pay their bills around the same time. And so if you're able to look at a calendar and say, do I want to run my subscription renewal on Friday or Monday? Do I want to run it on the first of the month or the last of the month? Chances are, if you run it within a few days of the first of the month, you catch a paycheck. You run it within a few days of the last of the month, you may catch a user who's waiting for the next paycheck. And so we couple all these things together, whether it's the business intelligence about when the payment should run, the acquirer to use because they have the best footprint in the country, or the largest amount of issued cards, the intelligence of how to interact with that user, when to message them, and then the brand development of, as we answer the phone, we know who the companies are that we're working with, we know what the end consumer is searching for, and our entire objective is to make that customer happy.
Yeah.
Couple all that together, and this is how we go from 86 to 88 to 90 to 92.
Yeah.
And it's an extensively large and sophisticated operation, but when you're talking about 5 basis points over $200 or $300 million, it's more than worth it.
Yeah, it's worth it. Wow, really getting into the nitty gritty there. So many data points you need to be able to consider and quantify and find a way to get at. Let's move away from the pure payment side of thing for a moment. Just before the show started, you were telling me about the future of Nextway and IoT, pulling into a gas station and making a payment. Can you tell us how that may differ in the near future and how companies like Nextway are going to enable that?
So it personally drives me crazy when I have to take out my credit card, because we have so many identifying methodologies of whether it's near field communication, QR codes, my license plate on my car. That the shift with headless commerce means that we're enabling all these other devices to interact with us and to interact with our bank accounts. The shift in open banking versus the rails from the credit card companies, again, is making that even easier and easier and easier. To me, when we drove out of the airport in Montpelier yesterday, and the camera was able to recognize the license plate because it associated it with the card when we pulled in, so it just automatically opened the gate, yes. No depositing that card. That's the seamless interaction that that encourages the flow of traffic through a system. That works great. It actually caught me off guard that it worked because these things don't always go the way we want them to go. But that's our future. IoT is literally interacting with us in every aspect of our life, and whether it's the car telling you that it needs to be recharged or that it needs to be refueled, or your refrigerator telling you that your food is expiring, or your sports app that you keep on your phone telling you that it's time for different types of interactions, new equipment, all of these supplies that we have, everything is becoming a point of sale. Literally everything at this stage is a point of sale. And so our evolution into headless commerce and our connections with all of these IoT devices mean that the consumers can interact and publishers or IP owners can monetize at any stage of the game. And so that really has been a huge shift. And personally, I remember when South Korea was painting QR codes on the walls of subway stations so you could shop for groceries as you came home.
Yeah.
That still hasn't gone west. It's just starting to get there, but that connection between phone and QR code and trigger into product should have nothing to do with me taking out my credit card or having to enter a number.
Yeah.
And so that's really the biggest shift that's happening, is that we need to decentralize the payment method and instead centralize the customer. And so that the customer wants to interact with you at all these different stages, you shouldn't be forcing them to figure out how to pay you.
Yeah,
we should know all this and it should be seamless.
What are the blockages here? I mean, this sounds within grasp, and I imagine most people would be for of it. What are some of the arguments against it, or what are some of the laggards in this respect?
So the payments companies have invested a significant amount of money building what we describe as rails, which is a network to get access between where a consumer's money is, the point of sale, and who is going to benefit from that transaction. Those are, many cases, legacy networks that are extremely expensive and extremely profitable.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of reason to protect those networks and make those networks even stronger. At the same time, the internet, open banking, and PSD2 are sticks to break that. They're a crowbar to pry open access to a bank account so that anybody who wants to facilitate a payment into there that the consumer wants to pay can,
yes,
without having to pay middlemen. And so that represents a shift in payment technologies and payment methodologies that ultimately is a threat to our historic providers, Visa, MasterCard, and Amex, that's forcing them to develop new value-added services for their consumers. And so I spend a good 2 or 3 days on the road every single month. And the only way I would be able to do that without losing my mind is because I have a very, very good credit card. And so now when I buy things, I literally make the decision to buy them because of the insurance and the protections on the card. And that is, as a consumer, what drives me to use different payment methods. And now the reverse is true as a merchant. What's driving me is to look at all the costs of all those different payment methods. That doesn't balance. Right, that as a consumer, I'm looking for the value-added services of the credit card that protects me against fraud,
mm-hmm,
or protects me against buying a product that I don't like and I want to return and I want to charge back on. That's what the credit card companies sell me. As a merchant, the credit card companies charge me anywhere from basis points to 3-4%, depending on which methods. If you're using an Amex Platinum card, right, you've got some pretty expensive payment methods out there, and it's because they're encouraging the customers with all these services. That imbalance is, in my mind, threatened by open banking, because clear and transparent payment methods come with that protection. And so all these services are up in the air in my mind, and they're all being juggled, and they're all resistant to change. And so that word change is so fast, and it's happening so quickly. I always look east to see how it's coming west and whether it's going to be a WeChat wallet-style application or QR codes. But at this point, I look at the payment company as being the biggest hindrances to the adoption of the new technologies, because they can't get into these IoT devices and these interfaces as fast as agile payment companies can.
Yes.
Right? So look at legacy big networks, and then look at these really fast players who are coming into the market. Look at the monetization methods that NextWeek puts on the table, for example. Is in a couple of clicks and in a matter of hours, we can present to a reseller every local payment method in whichever country you're looking at. And this is hundreds of payment methods in hundreds of different countries. That is a huge threat to every single one of those payment methods.
I think this is a whole other podcast, to be honest. Obviously, quite controversial terrain for some of our.
Yeah, it is, and trust me, my biggest vendors are the payment card companies, and so like I'm really fully aware of this, and that's where when I dig in, I know Visa and MasterCard. Yes, these rails need to be protected, but the work that they're doing in innovation is much more than just consumer protections. And that's where I think all of this is going to have to quickly change, is that Visa and MasterCard do have these amazing rails, and you look at like B2B transactions, for example. I know of a lot of companies paying hundreds of thousands of dollars with credit card swipes through Amazon, or have a good friend who does media buying and she puts it all on her Amex, right? And that's because these rails exist to be able to move millions of dollars seamlessly between companies. That's a development on top of systems that existed. And so when you look at the payment companies, yes, dragging their feet is one way for them to maintain their position. Just look at chip and PIN in the US, for example, versus debit card transactions, right? Those networks took, it was right about the time that the iPhone came into play, starting to be able to take payments, that Apple forced the evolution of the point of sales in the US. So that these networks are dragging their feet, but at the same time, they're the ones investing in so much of the innovation to bring these new methodologies to market. And so while I blame them for the slowness, it's also through a lot of them that we're gaining quick traction. And to me, the window is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the innovation is happening faster, the payment methods are changing quicker. But then again, you come back to things like SCA too. And secure customer authentication, it got rolled out, it got forced, everyone is doing it, now it got stopped, now we're not doing it. Hmm. Where is it doing it? Who's required to do it where? What mishmash of systems do we have to deal with? That regulation, that change of regulation, the credit card companies, the payment companies fighting back, creates so much uncertainty that change is dangerous. So I think all of that is what's going on right now, which is why the adoption doesn't happen as fast as we would like it to. But those walls are falling down so quickly that it's inevitable. And it's going to happen. I think the next 3 years will represent more change than the last 10.
It's inevitable. Okay, so I'm gonna let you round up the show. Any last comments or anything you'd like to explore with our audience before we put a line under it?
Sure, and thank you again for the time. NextWay is really an evolving company. We went through a merger. We're going through a transformation right now. It represents, with Monetize, some of the latest technologies on the market, fully built on top of microservices, utilizing Docker. It represents on our sales and business development team some of the most forward-looking entrepreneurs. We also have a very good footprint of places you want to spend time. So we have offices in Paris, we have offices in San Francisco, we have a really great office in the south of France. We're sitting with some great locations in Tokyo. Our German presence is amazing. We've got offices in Switzerland. It represents a really cool company to work with. And as we are on the forefront of security companies and how they monetize their customers, we're really, really ahead of everyone else. And so you look at Netflix and Disney fighting over subscriptions, and we're sitting here being like, yeah, we did this 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so NextWay is still a very sexy and exciting company to work for when it comes to being on the forefront of payments. And right now, I think it's even more interesting because we're evolving. And what you will see from us next year is a pretty big evolution of these companies. And I'll leave it at that for right now because it is very sensitive, and our strategy is very, very exciting. We're all so thrilled about where we're going and what we've put together, that I think it's a great opportunity to participate in the company. It's a great opportunity to be one of its leaders. And on that note, we're very much always looking for talent.
Yes.
And so that's how we're connected, and that's how I know the payments and card network so well. And on that note, if you guys are talented in the payment space and you live anywhere
in the world
at this stage with internet connection, call us, because we're looking for developers, we're looking for business development, we're looking for nearly every phase of the company. And it's one of the most exciting times because our growth potential and our growth targets for next year are through the roof.
Incredibly exciting, and I think this is an excellent excuse for us to follow up at some point early next year. Can we do the next podcast in the south of France?
I think so.
Okay, I'll see you down there towards the end of Q1 maybe. KC Potenzone, the Chief Strategy Officer of NextWay, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
The Payments and Cards Network podcast is brought to you by our friends and sponsors, Payvision. Payvision, when it comes to payments, they don't mess around. They live and breathe payments processing, from design and integration to delivery and checkout and everything in between. Check out payvision.com. We are also brought to you by Block Data. Block Data is an Amsterdam-based cryptocurrency research firm. They help investors get involved in the world of cryptocurrency safely and securely. Check out blockdata.tech for more information about them. Thanks for joining today's show. We'll see you again next time.